You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 20th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, today is a pre-tape show. But fear not. Fear not. It is completely new material. You've never heard any of this. And it is a, it's actually a great interview with the author, Jeff Clements. He is also the co-founder of Free Speech for People. It is a national nonpartisan campaign to challenge the creation of constitutional rights for corporations. He is the author of the just about to be released, Corporations Are Not People. You can check out corporationsarenotpeople.com to get more information about the book. Bill Moyers wrote the foreword to it. And this is a conversation I had with him last week. I am indisposed today, ladies and gentlemen. And why am I indisposed? Because you know what? People sometimes need a day off to do other work because there are not enough of you who are members. Take that, you freeloaders. But I want you all to enjoy this interview. I think you will. It's a great interview, a very interesting topic. Centers around the Powell memo. And a guy named Lewis Powell, who we've talked about on this program before. You've probably heard the story about how corporations became people. Something was inserted, and Tom Hartman first reported on this in one of his books. I can't remember. Forgive me. A law clerk, former railroad executive, basically put it in the preface to a legal ruling back in the late 1800s. Well, Lewis Powell was the guy who carried this torch and really started the onslaught by corporations in the early 1970s and stretching over the next 30 years. And here's my interview with Jeffrey Clements. Remember, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. I need your support. I'll be back live tomorrow, Wednesday. I was live yesterday, Monday. Some of you can't even tell the difference because many of you podcast. You can also support this show by buying some coffee at justcoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. Buy your crap through our Amazon link at majority.fm. And you know the rest, blah, 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 blah. Here's the interview. Enjoy it. So, Jeffrey, I think people are... There is a vague awareness of Lewis Powell, and particularly in terms of his role in writing the somewhat famous Powell memo. I don't know if people understand Lewis Powell's role in making corporations, I guess, for all intents and purposes, people. But let's start with Lewis Powell before he is a Supreme Court justice. Who was he, and how did he come to write this
now somewhat famous Powell memo?
Well, it's a fascinating story. We have to go back to the late 60s and 1971 in particular. And Lewis Powell at the time was a respected lawyer. He had been president of the American Bar Association. He was from Richmond, Virginia. And he was a very effective advocate for corporate America. He served on more than a dozen international corporate boards, including Philip Morris, the cigarette company. And he was an advisor to the Chamber of Commerce. And so from his perspective, the response essentially of successful democracy in the days and months after Earth Day, when we had a Republican in the White House, Richard Nixon, 20 million people come out into the streets to say, you know, we're going to stop having corporations treat our rivers and our land and our air as sewers and disposal sites. And we had a wave of successful democracy. The EPA was created, the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Hazardous Waste Act, and so on. And this and other sort of restraints from the corporate point of view on corporate conduct troubled Lewis Powell. And he wrote a memo to the Chamber of Commerce, the one you quite properly references, a slightly famous Powell memo. It's what the Chamber of Commerce actually ended up calling it, the Powell memo, essentially saying American enterprise, free enterprise, is what he called corporate America, was under attack, and that corporate America needed to organize through the Chamber and other vehicles to channel money and influence and every other resource they could bring to bear for as long as it took, this is the gist of his memo, to use the courts, activist-minded Supreme Court, in his words, to transform the social, political, and legal landscape of America to favor corporations. And he got his chance to do just that when President Nixon appointed him to the Supreme Court about 6 months later.
Now, I mean, I don't think we can emphasize this enough. When you say he said activist-minded Supreme Court and used that very word, activist, which has become such a boogeyman word on the right, that's an actual direct quote from this memo. Now, before we move on to his role as a Supreme Court justice, there, and I want to dig into the memo, but even before we do that, is it your sense that Powell was reacting exclusively to the threats? I mean, you know, the time in which he writes this memo in 1971, we've gone through both a tremendous amount of social upheaval, a lot of social emancipation, and in some respects, the environmental awareness and movement was the first to sort of like impinge of part of this movement to impinge upon the economic the economic structure of this country, because in many ways the emancipation movement sort of split from labor, and the environmental movement was the only one that would have an implication for corporate America. Was that where he saw the biggest threat?
I think it's certainly a big part of it, and your point is a very good one. I think that this was really the first time where we had a national conversation and really a national policy decision that you know, there are some things that are just too high a price to pay for corporate profits, and you know, our land, water, and air and ecosystem is one of them. Of course, it turned out that actually was a very good generator of jobs and enterprise and business. It just wasn't the old ones that Lewis Powell represented at the time, but it actually ended up being a real driver of economic innovation. But apart from that, there were other laws as well. And we remember Ralph Nader and his consumer protection laws that he was driving with his expose of the auto industry. And from Lewis Powell's perspective in particular, his personal experience in essentially trying to help the cigarette industry not only survive but prosper when it was increasingly being revealed and understood by the government and by Americans that they were running a drug racket with an addictive substance that would kill people who used it. And his personal experience in creating this notions like corporate speech rights, something that had been unheard of in American history, the idea of corporate speech, were part of trying to fend off government warning labels and government regulation of the cigarette industry. So the environmental laws and the environmental movement were certainly part of it, but there were many other areas where I think America was really wrestling. It was a time of upheaval, but it was also a time of progress in a lot of areas, and wrestling with, you know, how do we balance big corporate behemoths and a big industrial economy with a good life and healthy communities for most Americans.
And you make the point in your piece that Powell's call for corporate rights should not be misunderstood as conservative, as a reaction to liberals, but rather that it is really much more of simply a corporatist perspective.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Sam, because I think the solution here, both to Citizens United and sort of unfettered corporate power that's doing so much damage in our country, is for conservatives and progressives and everyone in between to come together, get a constitutional amendment, and get other big reforms that you've had folks talking about on this show for some time. And so we need to look where we do have common ground, and this is certainly one of them. One of the areas. It's fascinating that Lewis Powell and William Rehnquist were appointed to the court on the same day by President Nixon, but they had very different records once they got on the court. So Lewis Powell wrote about four straight...
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeffrey, let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about Lewis Powell on the court and the difference between Powell and Rehnquist. And let's talk about... I really think it's important because I think people have this notion that the problems with corporate personhood have existed in this country for, you know, over 100 years. And it may be the case that they were first mentioned as people in a Supreme Court case over 100 years. But it really wasn't until Lewis Powell got on the bench that they forged what we now know as corporate rights. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about that. So, Jeffrey, when we broke, we had talked about Lewis Powell and his development of the Powell Memo, written in 1971 for one of his clients, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It was actually, I think he had entitled it about an attempt to restore the power of American, the free market, in response to what Powell and other corporatists saw as a growing empowerment by both environmentalists and consumer advocates and people who wanted to protect essentially what we know as the people's commons. And it was only 6 months later that Powell was appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, and he came out to the court with William Rehnquist, and both of their appointments serve in the piece that you wrote as an example to distinguish between conservatism and corporatism.
Yeah, that's right, and I think we even see it today with the, you know, I think many conservatives, their problems with crony capitalism and big, you know, corporate fueled government, not necessarily the commons, as you put it. We all have a stake in the public commons, and then this dichotomy between the corporatist and the conservative were really, you know, it was really well illustrated in the early days of this new modern version of corporate personhood and corporate speech that Lewis Powell carved out on the court. A consistent dissenter in those cases, when Powell had put together a 5-4 narrow majority to essentially create a corporate trump card over public interest laws, consistent dissenter was William Rehnquist, the conservative, appointed the same day as Powell had been to the court. And you had liberal dissenters too, Thurgood Marshall, of course. But it's interesting to read now and then that William Rehnquist repeatedly warning that corporations are not among we the people in the Constitution, that they're useful in the economic sphere but very dangerous in the political sphere. They can leverage economic power into political power, and that's very dangerous. And he essentially, in every case where Powell is carving out this new right of corporate speech, William Rehnquist is dissenting.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those examples, because, I mean, you outline the growth of basically coming out of another part of the Powell memo, which was the call for foundations and essentially what we now call think tanks to be developed to push this corporatist agenda. And shortly after the creation of this memo, you had the creation of organizations like the Heritage Foundation and I believe like the Cato Institute and a series of these slightly differing conservative think tanks, which were more or less pushing the same messages and also funded by the same backers. And this led to a lot of almost an assault on our legal system to promote this agenda with the end goal of essentially getting to Powell on the Supreme Court and letting him do the work from there. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we know Citizens United today, the case that recently struck down McCain Feingold in 100 years of regulating corporate money in politics. And the sort of prototype of Citizens United was a case called Bilotti, First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, who was the Attorney General of Massachusetts at the time, 1978 case. You go back and you read the briefs that were filed in that case, which led to striking down a Massachusetts law, by the way, that had said corporations should not spend corporate money in citizens' referenda. And the citizens' referendum at issue that time was a progressive income tax. And Bank Boston, Gillette, and Digital Equipment Corporation, some of the biggest corporations in the country, wanted to use their general corporate treasury funds to defeat it. And here we are 30 years later. We still don't have progressive income tax in Massachusetts. But that law to keep corporate money out of state elections, state referendum ballots, was struck down 5-4 with Lewis Powell writing the decision in 1978. And you had brief after brief, filed by so-called legal foundations that didn't exist until the Powell memo called for their creation, and they became funded and stood up in the years between 1971 and 1978. So we had the Washington Legal Foundation, the New England Legal Foundation, the Chamber of Commerce Litigation, National Litigation Center, these so-called legal foundations in every single region of the country, the Pacific Legal Foundation, the Northeast Legal Foundation, and so on. And they filed brief after brief, litigation after litigation, where they just kept pounding away. Corporations are people. Corporate speech has to be protected, that you can't discriminate against corporate speakers, and so on, using phrases really that hadn't existed in the law until that time. I mean, there was no such thing as a corporate speaker that the framers of the Constitution were thinking about when they decided we had to protect freedom of speech. It was a totally new creation out of the 1970s and these legal foundations and the Powell memo. And then Powell wrote those decisions, as I said, struck down environmental laws, struck down the ballot, corporate money and ballots law that I mentioned, struck down tobacco warning laws over and over and over again. And these foundations were a very important part of driving that agenda. And there weren't a lot of voices on the other side, I'm sorry to say, but I think we're seeing them stand up now.
And in the end, we're left with this legacy of Justice Powell. And, of course, really the only way to deal with it is some type of amendment to really fundamentally restrict the powers of the corporation in the country.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the good news here, is that Citizens United went so far, and it said so clearly, so that now we all understand what's happened the last 30 years. It was kind of under the radar. We knew something wasn't working. We knew corporations had a complete imbalance of power. We knew Washington did not respond to what the people wanted, no matter what it was. They responded to corporate and moneyed interests. But Citizens United essentially coming out and saying, corporations are people, and we're not allowed to regulate the spending of their money in elections, just like any other person, really hit most Americans hard. We don't buy it, and that's true on the right as much as the left. And there is a big national movement happening for constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United and this creation of corporate speech and corporate rights. It's you know, it's not unprecedented. We've had 7 cases of the Supreme Court reversed by constitutional amendment before. It's really the tool that was planned for just this kind of thing, and fortunately, it's being picked up by a lot of people.
Yes, hope springs eternal. But Jeffrey, let me get you to just I want to just return to one thing that has been, because I keep coming up against this notion of that this is something that true conservatives and on the right and those of us on the left can find a common ground. But one of the frustrations that I've experienced is that and I perceive at least some of those true conservatives to have a strong libertarian streak, and I think that's not inaccurate to sort of categorize Rehnquist in that respect. And you might know better than I, but when I see the response on the right to this notion of corporations corrupting our government and having too much power, the response I see is to shrink government, as if the absence of the sort of the infected body would somehow shrink the power of the infecting body. Can you speak to that for a minute?
Yeah, and I appreciate the sort of frustration that I think we all have a sense that, you know, the right is in agreement with us, and why aren't we working together to get this done? And that does come up. Well, but you know, let's shrink government, and of course, government is a very important counterweight to these powerful corporations and protects so much of the public interest. That's the purpose of government. But I think we still have to drill down really to specifics. And not necessarily get bogged down in conversations about how big government should be or should not be. So if libertarians and conservatives are concerned about, you know, big government, let's look at some of the reasons why it's big and go after those. So one of them, of course, is Medicare Part D, a corporate handout of 2003 that we're the only democracy in the world that by law is not allowed to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to get a fair price when the government buys pharmaceuticals for the Medicare program. It costs billions and billions of dollars.
Right.
It's a government corporate inside deal where the people's interest gets left behind. And that's something I think right and left can agree on. You can look at oil and coal and fossil fuel subsidies. That's not a free market. That is government handouts to favored industries. And we should be able to have a conversation about that. Even the health care plan, you know, I am a big fan of what President Obama is trying to do in ensuring all Americans. But when you cut out the public option and Americans are all mandated to become customers of corporations who have not earned our trust, to say the least, and how they're going to handle our health care, that's something that maybe the right and the left can share a concern about. And now, frankly, my solution would be single payer, which isn't for everybody
right.
on the right, but at least we can agree that, you know, $80 billion sweetheart deals with big pharma to get a mandated, you know, corporate-based healthcare system isn't necessarily the best solution for America.
All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Sam. Great to talk with you.
You too. Bye.
Take care.
Hey.